Hey guys, today's show is sponsored by Howl.fm, the Netflix for podcasts. Howl Premium gets you exclusive access to dozens of Howl original miniseries, like Good Question with Jack O'Brien. It's my podcast. Also, The Mysterious Secrets of Uncle Bertie's Botanarium, which is a really well sound designed adventure comedy starring Jemaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords. It sounds amazing. It sounds like no podcast you've ever heard. And yeah, you can access all of this through Howl Premium on your iPhone, your Android phone, or on the web for only $4.99 a month. It's super worth it. And if you use the promo code CRACKED at checkout, you get a full month free. So it's howl.fm, and it's seriously a no-brainer, amazing product. Go buy it. I got you stuck off the realness. We be the infamous, you heard of us. Official Queensbridge murderers. The mob comes equipped for warfare. Beware of my crime family who got enough shots to share for all those who want to profile. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Crack Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm back here with Crack. And this week, we're listening to music that I loved as a kid. Made me excited about music in the first place. And this was my favorite song for probably most of my life, Mobb Deep's Shook Ones, Part 2, off the album The Infamous, I think it was called. There's a lyric on this album that uses the metaphor that something's like mixing vodka and milk, meaning it's a bad idea. But me and my friend tried it to make sure he didn't mean that it's a delicious drink, and it wasn't, and we got very sick. Anyways, the reason I'm playing these songs that kind of deeply influenced my taste in music is because this week we're talking about cartoons and other children's entertainments, you know, fun stuff. We don't have to take that stuff seriously, right? It only lays the foundation for our moral compasses. My sarcasm muscle's tired. Obviously, we think children's movies are important. They influence how entire generations view the world, and they aren't very careful about what goes in there. They're careful not to put any blood and guts and, you know, hardcore fucking on the screen. At least we use the words happily ever after to yada yada past a lot of awkward sex between princes and women who, up until very recently, had fish sex organs or were in comas in two instances. Disney cartoons are so weird. We'll talk about that. And there's a lot of other shit that we ignore that gets crammed into our little brains to slow roast and ferment. And that's a gross image. For instance, 90% of the world just now coming into their adult years spent most of their childhood inside the imagination of J.K. Rowling. And we're going to talk about the fact that her moral universe has some weird shit going on in it. J.K. Rowling's actually mean. A Cracked writer named Tara Marie recently wrote an article on Cracked about famous works of art that have brutal insults hidden inside them. And we kicked that article off with this story about J.K. Rowling and the actor Stephen Fry, famous British actor who's the host of the comedy show in V for Vendetta, comedy partner of Hugh Laurie. And he narrated the Harry Potter audiobooks. And so while he was recording the first one, he and Rowling met for the first time. And the story goes that someone was like, oh, you know, Ms. Rowling has a sequel in the works. And he was like, oh, you know, good for you. And for some reason, that pissed her off. She was like, good for me? Good for fucking me? So it turned out while he was recording the first Harry Potter, Stephen Fry has a weirdly specific speech impediment that made it impossible for him to say the two words pocketed and it together. He said pocketed it. And it was no big deal because, you know, those two words only went together once in the first book and don't go together that often in the English language. But when J.K. Rowling found out he couldn't say those words, she put that phrase in every one of the next four books because fuck that guy for saying good for you, I guess. Now, this might seem like a random story to tell in a podcast about how kids' entertainment influenced you. It's not like we're going to say the persistent use of the phrase pocketed it brainwashed you into shoplifting, the beginning of Notorious B.I.G. song Hypnotized, where Puffy goes, take that, take that, take that, is the piece of pop culture that brainwashed me into shoplifting. But I do think it's an interesting look into how she views other people. The article goes on to talk about how Gilderoy Lockhart, the asshole teacher from Chamber of Secrets who tried to help Magic Hitler take over the world. He's based on a real person. She sort of Yersovained that one and was like, he probably doesn't know it's about him, but it super is, and it's super specific. Snape was based on a real chemistry teacher named John Nettleship, who had crossed her and who looked exactly like Snape in the movies. But Dolores Umbridge, whose name literally means Dolores Annoyance and Defense, she's a short lady who, like, dresses in all pink, who makes Harry write with a pen that carves letters into his flesh. She was based on a real teacher who Rowling hated, who she described as dressing like a three-year-old and basically described in so much detail that it would be impossible for her not to know she was talking about her. She described a bow the teacher wore in her hair that was similar to the one the character war. And I want you to imagine being that teacher for a second. Your student has become the most successful writer since God. And as you read her book, you find that there's this hateful, just despicable character, the only person to physically leave a scar on Harry Potter besides Voldemort, who's clearly based on you. She's a teacher like you, who dresses like you, has little trinkets on her desk like you do. And at first you're just kind of pissed because of how bad she makes you look. But then you become terrified because she has your character basically get raped by a bunch of horses. Anyway, we'll talk about it, but that's not taking a fun jab at a mean teacher. That is seriously fucked up. And I think it's important to at least understand that that's the sort of person whose mind you're kind of playing around inside of when you read the Harry Potter books. Just like it's important for those of us who grew up on Disney to realize we grew up inside the mind of a guy who thought women were better seen and not heard. And just in general, it's important to remember that Sebastian the Jamaican Crab instructs Ariel to, you know, take it easy and tamp down those ambitions she has and continue chilling under the sea. If you don't spend time around a lot of people with Jamaican accents, that's going to affect your expectations on the world imperceptibly. And that's when it's most dangerous, when it's imperceptible and, you know, you don't realize it's happening. Anyways, that's what we're talking about this week. Hope you enjoy the conversation, and I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Cause ain't no such things as halfway crooks. Scared to death and scared to look, they shook. Cause ain't no such things as halfway crooks. Scared to death and scared to look. Living the life that is diamonds and guns. There's numerous ways you can choose to earn funds. Some get shot, locked down, and turned nuns. Cowardly hearts and straight up shook ones. Shook ones. All right, I'm joined by Soren Bowie and Daniel O'Brien. Live from South by Southwest.
Not live. Oh,
Jack and the Chipmunks. The three of us back together again.
Brett, cheer. Cheer, Brett.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, we're just chilling in our South by Southwest house that we rented. And should we make it seem natural? And we were just talking, figured we'd record this, about bad lessons we learned from childhood entertainment. Actually, I watched Dan's video yesterday about how fucked up Pinocchio is and made me want to do a podcast about that. So that's what we're doing.
Yeah. We're confirming a whole lot of fan suspicions that we all live in a house together and talk about pop culture.
We do.
Like we just woke up in the house that we share,
right?
Turned microphones on.
Soren came down the fireman pole.
Just like his
loft.
Yeah. I don't know where you guys wanted to start. We could talk about the Pinocchio video. We could start with sort of generational differences since we are somewhat of different generations. Dan is slightly younger than us, but I do think that he had slightly different entertainment than we did.
We could start with Pinocchio. Just to get it out of the way for anyone who hasn't seen it, talking about why it's terrifying, and they're right off the bat, a lot of people before clicking on it were like, I know it's terrifying. That scene where they turn into donkeys is objectively scary, and the stagecoach driver looks like the devil. There's nothing secret about that. But none of that stuff is stuff that I wanted to touch on. I was focused more on the fact that Pinocchio goes from not existing to being this weird wooden accident monster who's like suddenly 8 years old, like with a fully developed vocabulary, but no clear understanding of what is right and wrong, and didn't have any of the very basic things we learn as babies that we don't even know that we learn. Like, I just feel like I showed up one day as a kid and knew not to touch fire somehow. But that's because I was taught that unconsciously by my parents. So he's just eight, and he's a wooden monster, and he's being raised by an old crazy man, and a talking bug is going to tell him what's right and wrong, and Jiminy Cricket clearly doesn't even have a clear sense of that.
Right.
Like, he's just a dumb fucking bug, too. Yeah.
He and just showed up.
Yeah, he showed up, and there, and twice in the movie when Pinocchio absconds with first the gypsy and then Lampwick, Jiminy is just like, well, I guess he doesn't need me anymore. I guess I'll just go then. And Jiminy just leaves, like just like completely abandons Pinocchio. So he's always had an uphill battle, and it's just ridiculous to me that at the end of all this, he gets turned into a real boy, like that's supposed to solve anything, but he's still this weird freak raised by an old man who doesn't know how to take care of even himself, and
right.
a cricket who can't lead him in the right direction, because Pinocchio's like, I need to rescue Geppetto. I'm going to tie a rock to myself and jump into the sea. And Jiminy's like, not without me, you're not. It's, so this is the dream team letting this suddenly eight-year-old kid leading him around the world. And I just feel like there's no way he's going to be fine. Geppetto's going to die in a minute.
Geppetto's like all-time bad Disney parent, I feel like.
Yeah, yeah.
There's that part where it's like 3 hours into Pinocchio's life and Geppetto's like, all right, now go to sleep because you have to go to school tomorrow morning.
Right.
He, like, what the fuck?
He prayed to God that he could have a son of his own. And he's like, oh boy, this is great. I've always really wanted to know what it would feel like to send a kid away every day. And finally, I get that joy.
This is a parent who willed his child into existence at an age beyond where he could have done all the really hard, laid the really good groundwork for what it takes to be a good social child. Yeah, my first word when I was young was hot, because we had a stove in the middle of our house and I wasn't allowed near it. And so ingrained in me were my parents constantly going, no, hot, and pointing at it. And so he
still
doesn't
to
have,
this day, that's yeah. what your parents do when they're around you.
He doesn't have any of that. And now he's got to go to school.
And he gets turned around on his first day of school because Honest John, a talking fox, which is a red flag to most kids, but not Pinocchio because he's not most kids. Honest John is like, don't go to school. Come this way with me and my weird cat. And he's like, all sure. right, that sounds good to me. You also seem like authority here. You're as much of a father figure as that insect and the old man who sent me away today.
And what's anyone going to say? Are they going to say, what are you doing? What, were you born yesterday? Yes, yes, honestly, I was.
It's been really hard. Everyone's taking advantage of me.
And it's absolutely believable that Geppetto gets eaten by a whale because he's just such a dumb fuck. It's like, yeah, if anyone's going to like get eaten by a whale.
It was my favorite part of the movie, rewatching it, when they get back, Jiminy and Pinocchio get back home from Pleasure Island. And they find a note that the blue fairy left. They're like, Geppetto went out looking for you and he got swallowed by a whale. Which is such a hard thing to do accidentally. But for Geppetto, it's like, yeah, probably.
Yeah, that fits.
That's about right. I think that's a great example of sort of the spirit of this episode is like, I want to look at stuff that people are like, yeah, I think I kind of get that. And just take a second look and be like, actually, that was like super fucked up. One example from a recent article that I don't think we hit hard enough is the Tim Burton remake of Willy Wonka is very clearly a metaphor for the Michael Jackson scandal, because Johnny Depp's character is very clearly inspired by Michael Jackson. It's like what he did with Jack Black, the pirate, with Keith Richards.
Jack Black.
Yeah.
Captain Jack Sparrow?
Captain Jack Sparrow. Oh, what he did with Captain Jack.
Captain Jack Black Sparrow.
Yeah. What he did with Keith Richards with Captain Jack Sparrow, he did with Michael Jackson for his version of Willy Wonka. And then throughout the movie, it's like these doting parents bringing their kid through this guy who's like clearly fucked up and is like inspired by Michael Jackson and is like abusing these kids. Clearly they're just like, no, like we're gonna stick with it because you're a celebrity. That's actually what happened. Like Michael Jackson was able to like victimize these kids because their parents were like fame hungry star fuckers, and so they like let their kids sleep over at Michael Jackson's house. And the message that it sends is not this guy's dangerous and like kids should not trust him. It's like this guy, this Michael Jackson guy, he secretly means well. Like if you just stick with it enough, kid, and like have faith in the clearly abused and damaged weirdo who wants you to like hang out with him alone,
you'll get all the candy you could ever want.
Literally, you'll get all the candy in the world. It's like the pedophile's ruse basically made into propaganda. Yeah. It's like pedophile propaganda.
Willy Wonka's factory could have just been a giant windowless van. Yeah, I didn't have any thought about that. But yeah, literally the moral of the story is, as long as you're a good kid, this clearly stunted, abused man will give you everything you want. Because the ones that aren't good kids, like the ones that are defiant and obstinate, that speak up and are loud and stuff, they're the ones that get it fucked by that whole system. But
right.
The kid who's good and compliant, he gets all the candy he wants.
It's like a revisionist history from the perspective of a kid who got abused by Michael Jackson, just being like, oh, I wish like this is what happened. Like, I wish he really did give me candy and did really like me.
It would be nice if I got a chocolate factory at the end of it instead of years of emotional trauma and an inability to get close with anyone.
And a general like disillusionment about how much my parents love me. So yeah, just generally fucked up childhood entertainments. Dan, you were pointing out the cartoons that we were raised on were like all generally
somewhat different.
Yeah,
this is something that I've been thinking about and trying to do something with for a while. It's not so much terrifying as much as it is like interesting, and I'm trying to think if there's any kind of link with how people my age in a margin of error of plus minus 2 or 3 years are forming now. I have two older brothers, and my oldest brother, I felt like his animation block was He-Man and Thundercats and G.I. Joe and just the, like, we are good and we are strong and we are powerful and we're the protagonists and we go and we fight evil. There are always, like, glimpses of that in my generation with Ninja Turtles and Power Rangers, even though that wasn't a cartoon. But the protagonists that I feel like I was fed growing up were that same Nickelodeon block of Doug Funny, Arnold from Hey Arnold, Rocco from Rocco's Modern Life. And, like, these are my identity characters, and they're all lonely, weird kids with deep imaginations. You know, like all of the adventures in Doug happened inside this boy's head. And it's all like the conversations that he wishes he was having with other people. He's never actually like actively doing anything important. He's just like spinning these flights of fancy in his brain. And I think about Doug and I think about Arnold, who is all like similarly the least exciting character in this show, and ditto Rocco, who's just like this nervous reactionary figure. And I think about that whenever I see BuzzFeed article after BuzzFeed article from people my generation who are so insistent that they're introverts and they're socially awkward and they're weird. And I just wonder if there's some kind of link between the protagonists that we were fed as these weird, very clearly indoor kids and this new rise in social awkwardness or sort of faux introverts.
But
and
Doug is like clearly mentally ill.
Oh, certainly.
Is the problem. Like, he has a definite inability to differentiate between fantasy and reality. The 80s equivalent of that is Never Ending Story, where like it's like a metaphor for a kid being sucked into a story, but he's like going fucking insane. Like,
right. If he's like, I want Doug talking to a therapist, be like, so how's school? Well, every once in a while I pretend I'm a superhero and the bully in school is a supervillain, and I banish him to the sun, and then I kiss this other girl in my class, and that sort of gets me through the day. And that's
right.
Like every day of his life is just digging into his head and coming up with these scenarios that make his life better or more interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, I used to do similar stuff like that. I used to like daydream and like imagine myself as like the hero of some action movie in school. But like, I wouldn't then come to in the middle of the road like Doug does sometimes. Like, where am I? It's like, I'm trying to think of a movie where like someone just like Donnie Darko wakes up on the side of a mountain and is like, what the fuck just happened? That happens to Doug all the time.
He's fight clubbing himself all around.
Right. Yeah. I feel like there's been two movements. One where it's like less and less clear moral universe, and then more and more abstract almost, where now SpongeBob is almost the modern art.
That's what I think
cartoons.
The generation after me, that's what I assume they're getting their cartoons from, this very more absurd show. Like SpongeBob was just past me, and just a show that I could never really get into because like, this is just silly nonsense that, you know, it's loud and bright and I can't stand it. And it seems like that's what the newer heroes and protagonists for kids are. Adventure Time, which is a great show for all ages, but it's another like very absurd show and Fairly Odd Parents. These are just like wacky fun shows. Like, we went from He-Man for my brother to boring introverted maniacs for me, and now just absurd madness, I guess, is what it's
surreal almost.
Surreal, yeah.
Like, there's like this surrealist era in cartoons. I think a lot of that is born from our inability to let cartoons go. We still treat every piece of culture like it belongs to us. Mm-hmm. And we're 25 to 35 year old men. So they have no choice but to appeal. And so there are still adults watching Nickelodeon and people coming to those shows and being like, well, give me something. So that's why Pixar is so successful, because you have to cater to not just children. You have to build a right. show or a movie for an entire audience that's of a lot of different ages, because they're going to appreciate it probably even more than those kids.
Yeah. Oh, man, we're so close to, I'm going to hate it, but I really would believe it would happen. People online writing fucking open letter thought pieces to Pixar about how they shouldn't appeal to children anymore. I feel like we're not too far away from that, from people from some 25-year-old being like, you don't need to make any more Cars movies. You should just do more Inside Out, but even less of the silly parts of it. Just make it for me.
Why wasn't it about the dad or the dad's boss? He has an interesting life. Yeah, I do feel like sometimes the winks and nods to the adults are like, I think it was Rocco's Modern Life had a joke that was like, someone was like, we need to fingerprint. So something
we need
about fingerprints.
We need fingerprints.
Oh, that's Animaniacs.
Animaniacs. And then they brought prints forward,
right,
like fingerprints.
Right. Dottie, get prints. Dottie immediately fetches the artist prints. And they go, no, fingerprints. And Prince looks at her like seductively, like,
are you gonna
hey,
finger my butt?
Little animated monkey thing. You gonna put your fingers in my butt? And she's like, no, thank you, tiny adult man. And she throws Prince away.
Yeah, you look at the ratio in Animaniacs or Freakazoid, the ratio of jokes that are clearly for kids and jokes that are for adults. And it's about 40-60. Like, the adult jokes really outweigh the kid jokes in those. And I'm trying to remember what I got from those shows other than that they were just cartoons. Because I would have watched fucking anything. I watched Hanna-Barbera cartoons for a very long time, and those are dog shit.
I really think that the adult jokes, like, nobody's watching Animaniacs with their kids being like, fingerprints, nice.
Right, because if someone...
It's for the people writing it to, like, maintain their sanity, I think.
If they snuck that fingerprints joke into, like, Airplane, and I was watching people do it where they were implying... No, I want you to finger that man. I'd be like, Jesus. Like, that's not a joke that I feel like is at home in adult content either. Just specifically to be confusing and naughty.
I want you to finger that celebrity.
And I could also, I think, now double down on this new mythos I'm building for Dan of his absolute repulsion to authority.
Yeah.
But... yeah, authority couldn't be trusted in a lot of those Nickelodeon cartoons. They couldn't help you, honestly. But then if you also, around that same time, where X-Men animated series, Spider-Man the animated series, Batman, Superman, those are all around the same time, obviously on a different channel. But it's a similar thing. The cops don't get better at their job. The cops are always this first stopgap that means nothing to any of these heroes because they just can't do their job right. That's why you need Darkwing Duck or like these other people, because I have all these images in my head of watching X-Men and just seeing a bunch of police cars or Spider-Man and police going, stop, and then the car's exploding. And like they're just not, and they never advance. So part of me, I think, growing up, as soon as we've had all this stuff happen in Ferguson and things like that, where these cops are getting tanks and armor and stuff like that, the part of my brain that's left over from cartoons as a kid is like, yeah, well, obviously, you've been fucking around for so long. You've just been getting blown up. You're just fodder for these villains. It's a weird dynamic. It makes you think that police just aren't good at their jobs as a kid.
It is, yeah. And I want the reason that Soren keeps throwing authority as my mythos, I'm pronouncing it like you did, but I think that's wrong.
Mythos? No,
yeah.
That's right.
Do we have a clip? I talk to Soren a lot about my problems with authority. I'm not like a vigilante or anything like that. I
hate your boss.
Yeah. I like rules, but I don't like being told what to do. Like, it's a knee-jerk problem that I have. And I think that's what Soren is calling out of the fact that I grew up with Spider-Man, who was like, the system is broken, I must be Spider-Man. And before that, these young cartoon shows where cops and beyond cops, adults in general, can't help you. You're just sort of on your own, and the antagonists are the world around you, and the way, and like the tools you have are your imagination and your ways to problem solve. And
I caught the tail end of a lot of that stuff. I like Spider-Man a lot. I liked X-Men a lot. And so I can feel some of that as well. But it is true that I still have, and maybe this is my white privilege showing, but I have like a real appreciation for police officers, where like if I see one on the street, I will wave to him, because in those cartoons that were like it, like
or
like
her
cops,
Soren,
yeah,
talk about privilege,
yeah, right.
No, he doesn't acknowledge female cops
in those cartoons, where especially cartoons like Cops, COPS, this 1988 cartoon. I'm maybe playing as those characters when I'm playing by myself, but I'm never imagining that I grew up to be G.I. Joe or Snake Eyes. Like, that's not the plan. Those guys are just the ones that are in charge, and I respect that.
Yeah. Because you're pretty close to G.I. Joe.
but I think everybody, every little kid was like, yeah, I am Hey Arnold. That is who I am. They're not role-playing that when they're off on their own. That's just who they are in their lives.
Right. You didn't go and play that game. It wasn't like Cops and Robbers or Arnold and Gerald. You know, I just sat there being Arnold in my brain all the time.
All the waiters in your grand cafe.
Hey guys, we're listening to Don't Ask Me Why off of the first CD my family owned. Probably the one that I've listened to the most in my life, Billy Joel's Greatest Hits, Volumes 1 and 2. And I wanted to play this song in particular because it's probably my favorite Billy Joel song, and it has this part that taught me to appreciate music production. Other cooler people had, you know, the Beatles' Rubber Soul and Sgt. Pepper's and Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, and I eventually found those, but this is the song that made me want to go out and find them in the first place. It's this one thing that happens on the vocals. They're like layered the whole song, and then at one point that we'll play for you where he sings throw their roses at your feet, he drops the layering, and the contrast just like has this cool effect where it just makes his voice sound like really clear and resonant. And it's still, to this day, one of my favorite moments in any song, and one of my favorite songs in general. Hope you enjoy it, and enjoy these words from
our all the servants in your new hotel. Throw their roses at your feet. Oh, fool them all, but maybe I can tell. You're no stranger to the street.
All right, I have two questions for you guys. Do you love books and never have time to read them? That's one question. My answer to that is yes. Second question, would you object to getting mental stimulation on your commute or while you go for a run? If not, then we've got the perfect solution for you. Unfortunately, we don't yet have that thing from The Matrix that teaches you kung fu in 5 seconds. But we do have sort of a slower and more enjoyable version of that. It's audible.com. Audible has over 180,000 titles you can stream or download to your iPhone, iPad, Android, Windows Phone, or Kindle Fire. And unlike other streaming services, you actually own the books and you can access them on any device, anywhere. They also have something called the Great Listen Guarantee. So if you don't like a book, you can just exchange it for a new one. No questions asked. I use this. I have something called the Gold Club membership, which means I get a book every month. I've listened to Ta-Nehisi Coates's Between the World and Me. Sometimes I just get a New Yorker subscription and have every edition of the New Yorker that month read to me, you know, while I'm doing other things, while I'm doing chores around the house. I've become so much more helpful to my wife around the house because I can do stuff and be getting my reading done for the week. And just for crack listeners, audible.com's offering a free 30-day trial membership. So all you need to do is go to audible.com/cracked and you're going to find hours of entertainment, and you're also going to show support for the Cracked podcast, and you're going to get a free 30-day trial. So once again, that's audible.com/cracked. Hey guys, remember when we did that episode about 18 months ago where Christy Soren and I went through all the scientifically proven ways that humans go about choosing someone to sex? We talked about how bars with red walls and red lights make people more likely to want to go home with someone. There's a reason that the red light district is a place where people make bad decisions. We also talked about how going to a scary movie with someone tricks your body into being sexually attracted to them because your body just equates increased heart rate with a case of the hornies. Anyways, our bodies are stupid. Science is smart. And now that you have all that info, we're excited to announce our new sponsor, Adam and Eve. If you're looking to spice things up in the bedroom a little bit with an adventurous toy or adult movie, this is going to be a hall of fame of euphemisms, you guys. You're in luck because if you use our promo code CRACKED, you can get 50% off almost any item in the adamandeve.com store. And that's not all. If you use the promo code,
You'll also get 3 free adult DVDs and a free gift. So once again, check out adamandeve.com and enter coupon code CRACK to get 50% off any one item. And when you do, you'll get 3 free DVDs, a free extra gift, and hey, while we're at it, free shipping too. So that's adamandeve.com and use code CRACKED at checkout.
Yesterday you were an only child.
So we've covered before on the site that like J.K. Rowling, a lot of her villain characters are based on real people from her life.
Coulter Booligans. I have not seen the movies.
But Coulter? Well, so Snape was based on a real teacher, and then there's one of the female characters who she like describes in this like really mean way about like how she has like all these stupid trinkets and stuff, and it was like based on a real writing teacher she had. Really vindictive shit.
This is the woman who makes Harry Potter carve his name into his arm or something, like carve like lettering into his arm that I won't lie, or
it's Mrs. Cramigans. I'm gonna keep making up Harry Potter names until someone stops me. Wait, I was sort of enveloped in my own bit, and I'm just now catching up to what Soren said. Did a teacher make Harry Potter carve something into his arm?
Yeah, here's the deal.
Is that what they do instead of writing on the chalkboard?
I know this peripherally because I also have not followed the series religiously, but a teacher makes him write down something about I will not tell lies, but she makes him use a magic pen with no ink, and as soon as he writes it down on a piece of paper, it carves that out of his hand, and it says it in his hand. Yeah.
Mean old Cramigans.
That's Umbridge, I think.
So Gilderoy Lockhart is based on a real person who was a teacher of hers, and Lockhart is a really bad guy who like helps fucking whatever, he who must not be named, rise to power. And she was like, don't worry, he'll never guess in a million years that he's Gilderoy Lockhart, but basically said who it was. So anyways, I think J.K. Rowling is like a really vindictive person, and this is the person that millennials have probably spent the most time inside the mind of. And I think her moral universe is also like super vindictive. There's a teacher who's like shitty in the books, and she gets dragged away and raped by centaurs.
Yeah.
And then after she's raped, she's like really like traumatized and comes back and like has this like distant look in her eyes. And then Ron starts making like clopping noises.
Oh man.
Centaurs are coming. Oh. She like jumps up and like runs away and looks really freaked out, and like they all laugh. I just wonder if she's a really mean-hearted person and like her whole universe is kind of like that, and that's more influential than the Bible to the coming generation of people. We've also just learned that millennials are like more uniform in their beliefs than any other generation, which makes sense because they've had these like huge cultural movements like Harry Potter, where like everybody
in the world
of a certain age has read that book. They're going to be influenced by the same things. Yep. They're going to have like similar beliefs.
And they have access to all things. I'm going to sound like everyone who has come before me and everyone who will come after me when I say that it was harder when I was growing up to like develop taste in things, because there was like an honor to staying up late and taping something off your TV, some obscure comedy special that you wanted to see, or there was privilege in being in a house where they happened to have Carlin or Pryor records around. And even like music, even just, oh, I'm really glad my parents liked the Beatles so I could be exposed to that early. And now the entire world just has, hey, do you want all music that's ever been recorded in human history?
Right.
Here are a bunch of free ways to listen to it.
And weirdly, like, that has made them more uniform rather than being like, oh, well, I'll find like my own unique thing. It's like everybody just listens to the same thing.
Yeah. Well, because pop culture still exists. Yeah, everybody's on a scatter plot now. So it's, and the scatter plot is much more tightly knit because you could have some sort of, you can have deviations from it and things that you discover yourself, but ultimately you have to be aware of pop culture if you exist in the world. And there's a clear line in that scatter plot of what pop culture is. And so that's what you're tied to.
But to Dan's point, it used to be that there was some almost pride in being able to find something obscure. And now it's like, there's not that pride anymore. Now everybody's like, oh, you haven't read Harry Potter? Like, that's
right.
The more thing. It's like pride in doing what everybody else is doing.
And as a creator, I don't know how you would develop an edge, which isn't to say that I think I have like the sharpest edge comedically or creatively or artistically or anything like that. But I had an advantage over anyone my age who wasn't staying up late to watch Late Night with Conan O'Brien, which is what I was doing every night in high school, just capturing this absurd, at the time, very edgy show that informed all of my comedic sensibilities. And, you know, it's a weird thing to do as a 14-year-old, and everyone else is going to sleep because we have school in the morning, but me and the other kids who were doing that, I was like, well, we're going to be a little bit funnier, a little bit more well-informed, and just like a little bit weirder, and that's going to impact everything that I do in the future. Now, it takes no work to stay up and obsessively consume Conan O'Brien, because you wake up in the morning and you can watch clips from his show on YouTube immediately, because they just come out as soon as the show comes out, and everyone is sort of getting the same, has the same access to these things that used to be exclusive or privileged. And I just don't, I mean, I think it'll be really hard for whomever rises up and takes over Cracked, whatever the high school students now, and I think it's going to be hard for them to stand out among their peers.
Yeah, or maybe they'll just use their personality or whatever instead of whatever videos.
Stealing Conan's.
Yeah, stealing Conan's.
Their winning smile.
Like, I was definitely heavily influenced by movies I watched growing up, I think probably more than most people. Like, I was like, that's what we write about now, is because that's what I'm obsessed with. But I was so obsessed with, like, underdogs and the underdog stories that I think it influenced me into, like, I would fantasize about getting beat up. Like, the way that Karate Kid gets beat up for a long time. Growing up in school, I'd be like, yeah, then I'll, like, get my ass kicked. And then, like, I'll come back. But first, I'll really get the shit beat out of me for a long time. Rocky is sort of a similar figure in that, like, he just gets the shit beat out of him. I guess he's not children's entertainment. But, like, that sort of permeated all of my pop culture growing up.
Yeah.
Like, Engineer Brett was saying that all sports movies, like the Mighty Ducks and like things like that,
you gotta lose
it's always
first.
Like the sort of scrappy underdogs who end up winning and like who you want to root for. And so that's what I fantasize about being, rather than just like the really skilled person who like practices a lot.
I understand that. I would say I didn't fantasize about getting beaten up, because I sort of was bullied. Like, I didn't need to be like, what would it be like if Dominic pushed me and ripped my homework? Dominic Mingione, wherever you are. I never forget anything. Because he was doing that, you know, like, I had that. But I took the same lesson that you did, that, like, Mighty Ducks and Karate Kid made it okay that I was weird and didn't hit puberty until 6 months ago. Because no matter how bad it always was, I was raised on movies and was like, this is going to make sense one day. Like that's, yeah, that's what was a real comfort to me, that was like, well, don't worry, because at the end I'm going to win state, whatever the fuck that means.
Right.
Because that's how
well,
movies
it's also
go.
Influences you when you, the second you're out of college, you're out of high school, whichever, wherever your schooling ended, that there's a real romance to being on your own in a shitty apartment to start off, where you don't have any food, where you don't have any money, you're eating top ramen. That you're part of that romantic story of being at the bottom and being like, okay, well, this is the part where I'm sleeping in a closet that smells like cat piss for a while. And you almost like that when you're 19, 18, 19, 20 years old. Yep. And because it means that later it'll add to your narrative, that what people will tolerate early on in their lives, because it feels like they're part of, yeah, they're building their own movie in their minds, is, yeah, this is that part where I'm supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be beat up by the world.
Yeah, this is a good time, as I need to point out, that this is a free podcast brought to you by Top Ramen. Top Ramen for the bottom.
That's good. And, you know, Harry Potter starts out getting abused. Like, he has to be abused. We talked about how Harry Potter and Matilda are both people who are, like, suffering from child abuse. Like, they're made to, like, sleep under the stairs and, like, generally shit upon by the world and their living situation before things turn good for them. And, I mean, I think that's just deeply ingrained, is that...
It's every story, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's, like, Cinderella. It's things like that.
Like old scripture, Hindi scripture. They, like, the Pandava brothers, they get banished first. They have to, like, go off into the wilderness by themselves for an awful long time. And then they can come back, and that's when they can start winning.
Hey, guys. Rare appearance from Brett. I think when I was bringing it up yesterday, I think what was really troubling and horrifying is that, yeah, it's good to root for the underdog, but the underdog doesn't really do any work. The Hawks and the Mighty Ducks, they have the best equipment, and they practice really hard. You know, the underdogs in these stories kind of just win by virtue of being the underdog in the story. They don't do any work, but...
There's always a montage, but I do agree. It's a really... Because here's what they do in every...
Comparatively, he's absolutely right.
Yeah. But because here's what they do in every underdog story to make it okay that the underdogs win, is that they also make the hardworking team evil in some way. You know, like, the Hawks were great because they put all this work in. But, you know, just for good measure, let's have their coach hit Coach Bombay in the leg with a hockey stick, just so you know that no one who works hard and does well can possibly be good.
Sure, but we all went to high schools where there was the high school from across town, the private school. Maybe you went to the private school that...
I did.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. But we had that where I went. The private school, who was the evil school, they always won because they recruited the best people and they had the best equipment and they practiced harder. And Michael Jordan was the best because he practiced all the time and never had fun. He is not a Mighty Duck.
He's got nothing but competitiveness in his blood, like to the point where I think it's probably affected his relationships in his life. But yeah, they're not totally wrong that those guys are the assholes. When they treat the Hawks as the bad guys, in a normal social setting, they might be, because what it does to you to try and be like at an Olympic level, if you're going to continually practice at something every single day of your life, you sacrifice other elements of your character. And so that's not crazy. But then to watch these kids, these upstarts come in for a 15-minute training montage and kick their asses, we love that because we are that guy. Like, we haven't been training.
Yeah.
But for those guys, there's the whole work ethic there that we're just completely ignoring.
I know, I think that's a really good teachable moment, that a lesson that could exist in more children's entertainment is the unseen epilogue to any of those movies. You know, I want the bad guy from Karate Kid or the Hawks from Mighty Duck to go home at the end of the movie and be like, "Dad, I worked all season. This is all I did. Like, I broke up with my girlfriend so I could focus on this game. I tried so hard. I did everything I was supposed to do when everyone else was out fucking around and playing with stupid Goldberg from the Mighty Ducks. I was doing my drills. I was practicing." And the dad has to be like, "Sometimes life is like that and it doesn't make sense and I'm sorry, and sometimes we just lose no matter what."
Yeah, maybe Whiplash was a kid's movie.
Yeah.
Whiplash is the one movie that dares to be like, hard work is, it's not always pleasurable.
It's brutal.
It's mentally unhealthy. And once you push through the thing about being like, well, I should go out and like date because like if I don't go on a date with this girl, then like my life won't be full. Once you push past that into a place where you're literally losing your mind, that's when you achieve like real transcendence. That's
it's borderline abusive.
There's sort of this idea that hard work is bad for you. Like, I grew up thinking that, oh, you work too hard, you'll die of a heart attack or you'll die at a young age. And like, the actual truth is that the thing that kills people is retiring, because hard work and like having a purpose, people don't die from that. People, if they're like working up until the end, they'll live longer. Retiring is one of the fastest ways to like die early, but that's the opposite of like what you would see in movies. That message is almost like propaganda against that idea that working hard is like the way.
Yeah, I think there was probably a reaction to what was happening in the 80s. I think of Michael J. Fox's character from Family Ties. Deep pull, I know. But he's a young Republican in the 80s, and I think that that was a very popular thing to be, because it was in reaction to the decade before that, when there was a lot of free love and there was a lot of these aimless hippies that didn't know what they wanted or where they were going. And people went, no, it's okay to have a work ethic. It's fine to have this. And then beyond the 80s, we went too far in that direction. It's always trying to get back to the middle, but we went too far into the direction of, you have to have a work ethic. This is how we created the Wolf of Wall Street. This is how we created these people that are like wearing suits and talking on their phones 24/7. And that has become like a derogatory term, a suit, because they are these guys who we assume are going to have these heart attacks by the time they're 40, stressed out by their jobs because they're living to work instead of working to live. But again, we're swinging too far. The pendulum swinging too far in the other direction. We're like, no, they're fuck them. They don't know what they're talking about. You be whatever you want at any point in your life, whenever you want. And that's, I think, exactly what you're talking about, Jack.
Yeah. Whiplash is literally the only movie where somebody doesn't find true love, and that's why he achieves his goal, kind of. And like, obviously Whiplash doesn't end with him like hoisting a trophy over his head. He's very much lost his humanity and like gone to the dark side, but he is doing what he's always wanted to. And if people haven't seen it, it's this guy getting abused by this teacher who's like really hard on him to the point of what is the common definition of psychological abuse. He tells on the guy who abuses him, gets the guy fired, but then at the end he breaks through to this like transcendent level of directly drumming. Because yeah. like it could be for anything, but he breaks through directly because of this sort of John Kreese, you know. John Kreese is like the bad sensei from Karate Kid who like abuses his kids to like make them good at karate. It's like the story of if John Kreese in the end made them good and they were yeah. like, wow, we're so good at karate now. It's, like that worked.
It's so crazy. If Whiplash were any other movie, he would reject his teacher, reconnect with his girlfriend, and then achieve greatness in drumming through that way. Being like, you know what? No, it's healthy love life is what makes real greatness. Or he would realize, you know what, I thought the genius was going to be in drumming, but it's I was wrong. It's having a son. This is truly the most important thing I could do. But Whiplash doubled down on, nope, the crazy teacher was right. The teacher who has done this so many times that past students have killed themselves were still like, yeah, but I mean, one in four didn't kill themselves, and this one is the best drummer alive right now. He's in this exclusive, like, it's him and Yo-Yo Ma and Bill Gates in the class of geniuses that exist on the planet. So, like, there's something to it.
Yeah, the whole, like, idea of fun and, like, underdog stories. I feel like the thing that was happening in children's entertainment in the 80s, and I think well into the 90s with Mighty Ducks, but in the 80s with Karate Kid, like, that sort of disingenuous, you don't do the really hard work and the evil thing, and you still make it. I think that was reflected in, like you were saying, the hippies. Like, Steve Jobs pretended like he was still a hippie, but the way that he made Apple was by, like, fucking stealing other people's ideas and then just putting John Lennon on the front of it and being like, think different. But, like, what he was doing was just stealing all the best ideas from other people and, like, being a really shrewd business person.
Think like Wozniak didn't take as a logo.
Yeah, exactly. The Whiplash thing touches on another kind of terrible message that I feel like you get in a lot of Disney movies and a lot of kids' movies.
Oh, that's right. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. But this idea that young love is like the most pure type of love. Like in Disney movies, if you're single at age 30, if you're not married as a female at age 30, you're like a disfigured crone. You are either insane or evil. Every Disney princess, really, up until Frozen, I think, was like married by age 20, 22. Yeah. And like that was portrayed as the most perfect relationship and the thing worth sacrificing everything for. And I've never seen a movie other than Whiplash, again, a children's movie, that has somebody not choose young love and has it like work out for them. Every other movie, it's like, go towards your fucking high school girlfriend or boyfriend. Yeah. That's the thing to fight for.
It's connection.
Like, that's terrible advice
to somebody of the opposite sex. And that does seem strange, because the first relationships in your life are the ones that you burn. Those are the ones that are only there for practice, essentially. The fact that movies are constantly telling, especially kids' movies, are telling you, no, that first love, that's what's important. You gotta, if you like somebody, don't let go of that. That's the most important thing. And that won't be true for you in your life for another decade, maybe
Romeo
two.
And Juliet were so in love, they killed themselves. And that's like our ideal standard. They're fucking 14 years old.
Yeah.
Right.
They just met at a party wearing masks.
Yeah, that story, that's a tragedy, but we're like, oh, true love, Romeo and Juliet, 14-year-olds who kill themselves because they think that they've found ultimate true love. That is the thing, that like Romeo and Juliet should be seen as a cautionary tale, because that's something that everyone's going to think is like, you have a crush on someone that is unreciprocated, that is the end of your fucking life when you're a teenager, you know? But movies are like, it is the end of your life. Like, that's
you're
basically
right.
Their message.
You were right.
Isn't it? Yeah. That is the only way you're ever going to find happiness, is their fucking message. It's just like such a weird one to like go with the grain of what your fucking fucked up
crazy
like,
teenage
brain would think.
Yeah, that's true. There's a really great ancient Greek story about a guy who wins all, like, goes to the Olympics, wins every event in the Olympics. Oh, no, twins. I'm sorry. They're twins who win every single event.
The movie Twins.
They win every single event. They win the chariot horse racing, which is like the big one. And then immediately after the Olympics, they die. And everyone in ancient Greece was like, yes, these guys did it. Because the final goal is to be like this pinnacle of the human condition and be like these guys who are like physically stronger and better than everybody. And what to achieve after that? And that's sort of what we're, the same message we're getting from Romeo and Juliet in a different direction, which is it's fine that they die because the ultimate goal is that love. Like the credits roll after the love. What else is there? You find that and then you achieve it, and then that's all you need. It's such a weird, dark thing to tell kids.
Bringing up ancient Greek stories that were like their cultural myths is interesting because it's just so weirdly specific that all of our Disney stories are like from these middle age, medieval peasant tales that they told each other as like cautionary tales. All of our like childhood imaginations are shaped in these universes that are like based on these like really weird value systems where it's like young women are like married off by 14. That's based on like the dowry system and like people exchanging land. It's like such a weird Western European thing, but all Disney movies like take place inside that fiefdom.
Yeah, I know, I guess I never really thought about that, but yeah, Disney does borrow pretty heavily from a very specific part of the world history. All the stories come from that. And yeah, a lot of that stuff is really antiquated. Some of it's so antiquated that Disney recognizes it and pulls it. And that's why we can write articles about how horrifying the original stories are. But in a lot of ways, they keep some stuff that maybe they didn't realize was as horrifying as it is. And we end up with that in our movies. And now that exists in my belief system. Those are make up my morals now.
Yeah, like the Little Mermaid is fucking insane. She like dies in the end.
No, in the original? Oh, she kills herself. Yeah, she kills herself and turns to foam because she can't kill him.
Right.
Who's she trying to kill?
Eric. Well, the prince. His name's not Eric in it. But yeah, she has to, by the end, part of the deal is that she has to kill the prince to get back her fishtail. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But she can't do it, and so she kills herself and turns into foam. But even in like, so, but the one that we got isn't totally great either.
No, but, but I understand why they made their changes, though.
Right. Did we talk in the other one about everything is based on an economy of your power comes from being the most beautiful person in the land?
Yeah, they're certainly tied inextricably. Beauty and power are tied. Right. Well, beauty, yep. Power, and goodness, I guess. It's like the trifecta in all of those movies is if you are one of those things, you inherently have the other two. I guess with the exception of maybe Beauty and the Beast.
Although he's a fucking handsome beast.
Yeah, like Gaston should be the hero of that story, you'd think. In any other Disney story, Gaston would be the hero. And they make a very big point of making him not, even though he's the most handsome lad in the town.
Right. He is like designed exactly like the protagonist of Hercules. He has like a big jaw and like giant arms.
Yeah, but he's got that butt chin and those sharp...
Women like that.
They got those sharp eyebrows and like smaller eyes than they give most... Like there's a big difference between what Disney has programmed us to think a handsome man looks like and Gaston. Gaston is someone that like... Yeah, on paper, I guess he fits all the criteria. He's strong and has a full head of hair and a smile. But Prince Eric is sort of their standard for what an actual handsome man looks like. And there's tremendous differences in their jawlines and their eye shape and like the softness of their features.
Yeah, he has soft, nice eyes.
Yeah,
Eric.
Yeah. Gaston is so like sharp and angled and closer to like that serpentine Jafar-like look than anything else.
He looks like Jax from Vanderpump Rules. Am I right, ladies? Yeah, I do think
what
men are...
What the fuck is that?
It's Bravo. It's that Bravo
it's
show.
It's a Bravo show.
Jack is talking about.
Only like middle age.
Jack's really trying to get us hard to watch.
Yeah.
Trying hard
well,
to get
I saw
show.
Him here. Jax was down at South By. We hung out.
Could it be that you're not actually upset with him, but the fact that his name is so similar to yours?
Yeah. He has more of me. Jax.
Plural of you.
Multiple. What an asshole. But I do think men are like mostly spared from... this, or at least it's not as clean cut, but like even Frozen, this is the one thing, like Frozen like broke past the thing of like you don't need to get married, the guy might be an asshole like as long as you have your sister you're okay, but like both characters are like beautiful princesses who like everybody's like God, I want to marry you, like that would be the best thing if I could just marry you, and like you knew you were in trouble from Jump Street because they started with Snow White, which is a monarchy where power is defined by being the most beautiful person in the land.
Right.
And like the wicked queen, whatever, the evil queen daily consults a mirror like it's a straw poll being like, am I still the prettiest? Do I still have the most power? And then like once someone else gets more power than her, it's like she has to kill her.
Right.
Like, just also, like in modern American politics.
I never thought about how strange that process is because the magic mirror doesn't exist outside of time in a way where he knows all that is going to be. It's not like Snow White was born and he's like, this one's going to be trouble in 16 years.
No, I think he does.
Because, no, if she consults him every day, he's like,
oh, right.
Night of the fairest. And then one day he's like, nah, this one, this is, she is ripe now. She's ready. Like, I've been watching this baby and was like, I'd still rather fuck the queen. But, like, today, no way.
This Olsen twin to be 18.
1,000%. Yeah, she just turned 18, so I'm flipping it. It's her now. You're busted. Get out of here.
Yeah, that is power in that kingdom. To the point that once the prince just, like, goes by and is like, whoa, sees her asleep, which is the only time, like, her superpower is to look pretty while asleep. Because, like, if you
notice... there's got to be a good title for that movie.
Right. Well, Sleeping Beauty. Exactly. But, like, the other message that they're sending is, like, women are at their best when they're pretty and when they're not fucking things up by being awake.
Yeah. Or having a voice.
Little Mermaid. Yeah, taking her voice away is when the prince falls in love with her.
Yeah.
In Sleeping Beauty, or in Snow White, she runs away into the forest and passes out. And that's when the forest creatures come up and they're like, oh, she's so pretty when she's passed out, and like help her and like,
you're so pretty.
Right.
So
and then pretty. She goes, wanders into a fucking like stranger's house and falls asleep in these like seven tiny little beds. The dwarves are about to murder her with a pickaxe. Like, that's literally what happens. They like walk up, raise the pickaxe to jab it through her fucking skull. And then she, in her sleep, rolls over and they're like, wow, you're pretty asleep. So, and like fall in love with her while she's asleep. Disney really is driving this home that like, better seen and not heard, ladies.
Right. And I don't know what that implication was supposed to be, where they're going to murder her and then she rolls over and they see her face, like, no, let's just take turns fucking her while she's asleep. Like, I don't know what their plan for keeping her around was.
I think rather than them creating it, I think they're reinforcing something, maybe irresponsibly and recklessly, that's already ingrained in us. In the same way that those stories about beauty is so important, is something I think maybe, and this is maybe sort of sad, but that we're born with, that they've done studies with babies and they'll stare longer at a symmetrical face. Like, a face that's considered beautiful, and like they're
fucking babies,
they're more and trusting again, of a beautiful person.
Again, yeah, that's fine. Humanity, like, we're not naturally great beings. Babies are actually fucking liars and greedy, and like they will steal. They're just not good people. But like, you don't need the very first entertainment that they're shown, the very first like fictional world that they're ever like put inside of, to be a world that just reinforces that. That's like, hey, that like really shitty naturally held belief that you have, go with that. Like, that's exactly how the world should work, by the way. And then Snow White, at the end, the prince comes by and sees her passed out in a glass case, and that's how he falls in love with her and like marries her like on the spot.
Feel like we've thrown Snow White and Sleeping Beauty into a blender. And
I swear to God,
she's in a glass case at the end.
She's in a glass case. So she eats the apple. They're like, man, she's dead. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to bury her because she's so pretty when she's dead, that they put her in a glass coffin, and all the forest comes by and just looks at her nonstop. The prince rolls by on his horse and is like, that is a pretty dead woman, and I'm going to kiss her. and comes up and kisses the dead pretty woman. But again, this is her only power. Like, when she's using autonomy, she's a fucking mess. She's like walking into strangers' houses and falling asleep in their bed. What the fuck?
It's kind
of
Robert
thing
Denny Jr. move, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Eating poisoned apples from like what's clearly an old witch. The evil queen, the disguise she uses, is old witch.
Right.
And Snow White's like, you look evil. Sure, I'll take your apple. So she's just a dizzy moron who's like constantly like putting herself in danger and then getting bailed out by the fact that when she's not doing anything, people think that she's pretty. And that is everything basically grows out of that, because that is the first Disney movie, and from that is spawned Sleeping Beauty, Little Mermaid, where the prince falls in love with her when he can't hear her voice.
That's one of my favorites, and I'm sure I mentioned this in Obsessive Pop Culture Disorder a few episodes back, but he immediately falls in love with her when she's singing. Like, that's what he sees, this face, this woman who rescues him, and she's singing, and he's like, oh. And he's even talking to Grimsby about it. He's like, that voice, I can't get that voice out of my head. And then he meets someone who looks identical to her but can't speak at all. It's like, oh, this is even better. This is
exactly. Yeah, she also is basically a cannibal. We've talked about that. Like, Disney's all about the cannibal. Like, she totally sits down at a table with fish, who are her best friends where she comes from.
Birds too. I mean, like, there's she's got a seagull friend. They did that.
Yeah, they just didn't give a fuck.
Cartoons are not careful about it. I think Rocko's Modern Life did intentionally, where Heifer would eat burgers constantly.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are so many cartoons where they just dismiss it completely. We're like, well, it doesn't matter. It's cartoon universe. Right. But yeah, they are all eating each other constantly.
Should we talk about how crazy homoerotic He-Man was? What I think that's done to me?
Absolutely.
Pretty hot in a super gay way.
I think I was just a little too young for Masters of the Universe. I think I had a lot of the toys, but never watched the cartoon.
Our columnist Chris Buckles has pointed out that there was a character called Fisto who had just a giant metal fist and bondage gear, like wore bondage gear and was just, everybody was ripped. He-Man had fur underwear on.
Yeah.
Just super ripped. I do think that taken out of context, like if all cartoons were released today and we had never seen He-Man before, we'd be like, wow, that is really, is this a thing for like elderly gay men by elderly gay men?
I wonder about it though. There are a lot of cartoons that She-Ra, and maybe isn't the best example. Chitara. We've always had female characters that wear very, very little clothing that are very sexualized.
Yeah, that's true.
But our first impulse is not fucking lesbian show. But as soon as there's a guy show that has a bunch of that are wearing almost nothing that are super ripped, like, that's gay. Yeah. It's gay.
It's weird. I'm very split-minded about it because certainly in the 80s when these shows were out, it was harder being gay than it is now, and less content was being geared specifically towards you and your lifestyle. So the whole world pop culturally was aimed to make you feel more alienated and more alone. But at the same time, it was a simpler creative time in that you could call a character Fisto and dress him up in bondage and you could have this super sexy He-Man character for all the young confused kids to lust after if they want
power
to.
Derived from a sword.
And right, and no one's going to question that. Like, you couldn't make He-Man today because people would be like, oh, that's a pretty gay show. You're going to need to talk about that. Right. Like, you're going to need to take a stance on it. And this is the 80s where they're just making it and they're like, I don't know, I just wanted to give him some fur for his ball sack. What do you want? I don't know.
Right.
It's the 80s. Who cares?
The 80s was like, yeah, the 80s is just so fascinating because like they were horrible when it came to like gay rights and were like making fun of people. We've played that press conference where they're like laughing at the
AIDS epidemic.
They're laughing at the journalist who keeps asking about the AIDS epidemic and being like, do you have gay plague, Harry? And like stuff like that. So it was just like this horrifying era, but then also by far the most homoerotic era of any culture ever anywhere.
Ancient Greece? No.
Arnold Schwarzenegger was like rippling.
He's a walking boner.
Yeah,
he's
just right, exactly.
An erection, walking around, big veiny erection.
Yeah, they were just like super oblivious to that side of themselves. They're just like, we don't like that, but like they super did, obviously. Yeah.
And it was, you're right, the 80s in particular, because before that, the 70s, the heroes, they were kind of fat, schlubby dudes. They had like big, thick mustaches and they weren't objectively, I wouldn't say objectively handsome. Well, they were...
Yeah, or like with cartoons, it was like Scooby-Doo. It was like silly, like, you know, it wasn't ripped, jacked dudes who spend all their time lifting weights.
Like Charlie Bronson, I feel like. Charlie Bronson is a great example of what the 70s...
Of a between, kid's hero?
Between what Charlie Bronson was the action hero for so long, and then we got Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like, the difference between those two is amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it went way in one direction, like with their conscious mind, and like in the opposite direction with their unconscious mind. We want to talk about how Harry Potter's anti-technology. I think most kids' entertainment, they seem to prefer things to take place in castles, and you never see any cartoon really using technology.
No, you don't want anyone to have a cell phone.
Why?
I don't know.
That wouldn't hurt the plot of literally anything. Maybe Scooby-Doo, although they
right, I feel
like
every episode they'd be like,
service.
I checked the thing and ghosts aren't real, so it's probably a guy. Let's find out which guy it is.
Right. Even the Jetsons, their technology was super weird.
I feel like it's just like a lack of creativity on the part of the people making things. Like, I don't think it's as much a statement on, like, we don't want technology in our fiction. It's more just like, I don't know how to do it well. No one figured it out right. We had the luxury of growing up with so many stories that were already taking places in castles and in distant lands where technology hadn't reached it yet, that no one is doing really smart cell phone integration into their content.
No. The closest thing
Jesus,
we have,
I'm what the Fuck talks like that.
The closest thing we have to technology, I feel like, are robots that combine into other robots, like Power Rangers and stuff. They can ride around in these robotic animals and then be like, and then we'll also make a bigger animal. It's like, that's the most technology we want. Thank you. I don't want them to all have cell phones, too.
Any other lightning round observations?
We can talk about Winnie the Pooh at all.
That's
a weird one. Like Eeyore. Eeyore is a weird person to have in your life and not do anything about.
That is true.
Never checking in to make sure Eeyore is okay.
Yeah. We've covered the idea that like they introduce kids to mental illnesses, but you're right. It's like completely untreated and like ignored mental illnesses.
Yeah. Everyone is completely self-involved in that show. Like the reason no one's helping anyone is that they just don't give a shit. Like, how are you doing today, Eeyore? I'm real on the edge,
I don't feel...
Right.
Thinking I might emoliate myself.
Yeah, this might be the last you see of old Eeyore. And Piglet's like, that's fucking crazy, man. I can't handle that. Have you ever been outside? It's so windy and everything's so big and scary.
Clear anxiety
and
just like, disorder.
Yeah. And
Tigger
just like,
is
you got it.
Constantly just like on a manic episode, losing his mind. They're all wildly unhealthy.
Yeah.
And Pooh is just clearly a marijuana addict, I think.
It does seem to me, though, that Eeyore is worse off than all of them. The other ones, it could be...
Oh, my God, he's the saddest character.
But what a what a weird character to throw in and never address in your stuff. Because there's cries for help every single day from Eeyore. Yeah. I mean, he's putting it out there that he's not happy.
It's a terrible...
Like, oh, Eeyore.
And they make, like, there's nothing redeemable about him either. Like, as a kid watching that show, because I didn't watch it too much, but whenever it was on, and I was like, let's go check in with Eeyore. I was like, no, fuck Eeyore, he sucks. Like, that's what it was teaching me to do with people who were depressed in my life. It was like, nah, I'm not gonna hang out with her, she's such a bummer.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna eat.
Yeah, the generation that was raised on Winnie the Pooh and being like, fucking Eeyore, that guy's the worst, grew up to write Debbie Downer, the thing where it's like
the
character who's, the SNL character who's like funny because she's sad about things. It's like, and then like we're all like, you're such a Debbie Downer, ha! It's like, and then they wander off and jump out a window.
Now, the thing about Winnie the Pooh, because I thought the conceit of that show was that it's all taking place in Christopher Robin's imagination. Like, they're all stuffed animals that he hangs out with. Like, we're seeing the manifestation of me in a room talking to my action figures and making them fight and kiss or whatever it is that I was doing.
Yeah.
Like, this is the embodiment of that. So, are we to assume that all of these are living with inside Christopher Robin? That, like, this is just, each thing is a different part of him?
Yeah, I mean, that's the best story. That's the best narrative. Is that, you ascribe your different emotions and these pieces of you that you don't quite understand to characters so that you can get a better grasp on them.
Right. There's this poor kid who sometimes just... Eeyore is how he sees himself sometimes, as this miserable thing that no one can help, and he just bums everyone out.
That's a pretty big one for a little kid. Like, if I was inventing characters, maybe I would land on a rabbit or a piglet, I get. But man, Eeyore is just so dark.
Yeah.
Inconsolable sadness.
Yeah.
I could maybe come up with it now if I'm writing a story and want to come up with some characters, but if I'm a kid inventing one of the, like, an imaginary friend, essentially, I never had it in me to believe that someone could be so sad that they're beyond the reaches of help that, like, okay, I'm going to play a make-believe game with my brother, and I'm going to pretend to be this character that, like, no one even tries to cheer up because they know it's impossible. Like, the world knows that it's impossible to help Eeyore. I am blessed that I never had that
feeling in me. That's a character trope that shows up, like an archetype that shows up in other places. The only place I can think of it is in the Neverending Story, he goes and meets that turtle. That giant turtle who's like sick and can't move anywhere.
We don't even care whether or not we care.
Right, the Krang.
Yeah.
He goes and fights Krang. And the turtle's just waiting for the nothingness because at least the nothingness is something. And so it's just waiting to die because at least that's a change. And that was a pretty heady thing to throw at children in the Neverending Story. But those are the only two characters I can think of that are that pronounced in their depression.
And in both cases, no one helps them. That's so rough.
No. We don't even check in with that turtle later either. When everything comes back at the end.
We see Artex is back. And
the bat and the snail.
Yeah. But the turtle who just wanted death because it would be new. We never check in
with that turtle again.
The Smurfs are clearly Nazis, I think.
Really?
Well, they're all...
And that's all the time we have.
It's a very homogenous society. Everybody's exactly the same, and the bad guy is like this very clear Jewish caricature analog. Of a Jewish...
Ugh. Well, I didn't think about that.
Yeah. Does he want to... He wants to eat the Smurfs, right? He doesn't want
to
like
wants to put them
like
into gold. Turn them into gold.
He wants to turn them into gold. Yeah, yeah. It's a money thing. Yeah, that's yeah. that's very that's not good. Like gross.
Not good. The Smurfs.
No, it was certainly not my generation. But I'm always kind of lying whenever I've written a cracked article or done like an after hours where it's like the Smurfs were teaching such horrible lessons to kids. Oh my god, can you believe it? Because I didn't watch that show because it sucked. It's boring. It was such yeah. a boring show. I don't think we're worried about kids growing up to be Nazis because that. Piece of shit boring blue people show was bad.
Yeah, I mean, well, the conceit we're all living with here is that I don't feel like we're terrible people. Cartoons made us maybe who we are, but we came out all right.
That's what you would think, even if you were not all right.
Poor Eeyore thinks he's doing just fine.
By the way, the creator of the Smurfs was born in Belgium in 1928 and lived under Ooh. Nazi occupation. So it's not great. And there was also a point where Smurfette, something bad happened to her, and she became dark-haired and, like, weird-nosed and stuff.
Oh, no.
And then she, like, went back to being blonde.
Phew.
We've talked about how Babar is a colonial apologist.
Yeah.
Which is true. And Thomas the Tank Engine lives in a totalitarian dystopia. Where once you stop becoming useful, they just like put you out at this like horrifying train yard.
Decommissioned.
Where you just like sit there by yourself facing a wall.
Oh, man. Yeah. Or we talked about Curious George, that it is this weird analog for bringing a savage. I'm doing air quotes, by the way, because I don't want that word to be mine. Bringing a savage to the new world. That there's like this man in a yellow hat that goes to another country, steals this cognizant animal and
puts
brings it back and puts it yeah and then brings it over and sets it loose in the city.
And those aren't like metaphors. We're not saying like puts it in chains because he like puts him in a fun little monkey cage. No. He literally like in the episode, the origin story of Curious George, he like puts him in slave-like chains, puts him on a slave-like boat,
yeah.
takes him to America, goes into a city and is put into prison by the cops.
Right. It's all presented in a way that's like, this is great for George.
Yeah,
this is a really good thing for him.
Which, I mean, like, that has to be unintentional and intentional invention on the part of the creator, because we've probably traveled with animals and we've put them in cages. Like, you didn't need to put them in chains. That's a very specific choice where he's trying to send a message instead of doing, like, it doesn't take long to research. How would you get a monkey across the sea? You put him in a cage like you would a dog, taking them anywhere. He didn't do that research. He was like, no, I want to put it in like little monkey handcuffs.
That does happen, right? I'm not making that up.
It's in the book, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There are chains. All right, lightning round over.
Night swimming deserves a quiet night. The photograph on the dashboard.
All right, we're listening to Night Swimming by R.E.M., which was probably my favorite song off my favorite album as a kid. It came out when I think I was in sixth grade and changed how I thought about basically everything. And it's probably the first piece of art that I loved as a kid and still love to this day unabashedly, like MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice haven't aged quite as well. And as much as I love Billy Joel's greatest hits and think they're great pop songs, I'm aware that there's a lot of nostalgia mixed up in that appreciation. And as hard as I ride for Rocky IV as a work of pure pop indulgence, I've recently been forced to admit that it might not be the greatest American movie ever made. I guess Jaws and R.E.M.'s Automatic for the People are the things that introduced me to great art. And I guess it's appropriate since they're both about swimming at night. Two pretty wildly differing opinions on how good of an idea that is. And I think that's it. No real footnotes this week. You should check out After Hours if you enjoyed this conversation. It's a show Dan and I created, and we write with Soren and occasional co-host Michael Swaim and Katie Willert, where we cover stuff like this. And, oh yeah, I'd also recommend Mike Bedard's recent article about children's movies that teach kids horrifying lessons, which touches on the Willy Wonka thing I mentioned. and also points out that the Lego movie teaches kids that free will is an illusion. It's a pretty good article. Anyways, that's it. Thanks to engineer Brett, who you can follow on Twitter at Brett, R-A-D-E-R. You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien. And thanks to you for listening. And we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you guys then.
You, I thought I knew you. You, I cannot judge. You, I thought you knew me. This one laughing quietly underneath my breath. Night's swimming. Streetlight, a reminder, night swimming deserves a quiet night. Deserves a quiet
Hey guys, just a reminder that this podcast was once again sponsored by AdamandEve.com. You can go to AdamandEve.com and get 50% off almost any item in the store when you type in the offer code CRACKED at checkout. And when you do, you'll get 3 free DVDs, a free extra gift, and free shipping. Once again, use offer code CRACKED at AdamandEve.com.
Hey, how's it going? This is Chris Gethard.
Hey, Chris Gethard. I'm Anonymous.
Hey, Earwolf listeners. My new show is called Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People. Every week, I open the phone line to one anonymous caller, and I can't hang up first, no matter what happens. It's going to surprise you.
I could catch this train.
You're going to jump on that train?
Yeah, I think I'm going to try and stay on the call. I don't know how much time we have.
Ooh, I would love that. Move you?
I would rather go out having done something or try to do something really great.
Make you laugh.
I also sing about poop. I love to sing about poop.
It's Beautiful Anonymous. One phone call, 1 hour, no names, no holds barred. Listen on earwolf.com, iTunes, or your favorite podcasting app.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.